Programming Throwdown, episode 185, Workflow Orchestrators. Take it away, Patrick.
Welcome to another guaranteed to be fantastic episode.
That's right. Yeah, it's money back.
Yeah.
I nailed it.
We've been doing this too long. Okay. I'm going to try something a little different. I was thinking about this. I don't have a good formulation of it. So you can sort of help me.
All right.
But it's sort of been coming up in a number of things. And the sort of most obvious one is when people talk about venture capital, which is, investors, mostly tech investors, and they invest in, 100 companies, but really they're expecting sort of 10 to do really well. They're hoping the rest don't, they just assume they basically go to zero. They kind of don't care. And then they hope, one or two, 1,000x or whatever, and pay for the risk they take over the entire pool. And, part of that is this sort of like asymmetric returns. And then I began thinking it pops up in sort of other things. People were talking, most recently I was listening to someone talking about health recommendations, like how much protein should you consume? And people have this, maybe you did this much, maybe that much, maybe. And they were sort of said, up to a certain point, it kind of, is very, very important. And then past another point, you kind of get this like non-linear relationship. And then I began to think about it, and they kind of said something that led me to thinking about it in terms of work, which is if you set a certain target goal for how much you learn, in a given day or continual learning or how much output you want at work. I think internally we have this, sort of everything gets kind of normally distributed that maybe some days you're going to be a little bit above, some days a little bit below, some days, very rarely a lot above, very rarely a lot below. And in my head, at least, I think we do this thing that pops up intuitively over and over again where things kind of clump together and become sort of normally. And we think that the returns there end up being, kind of not super impactful. Like they even out basically, that the unders and the overs, are okay. But what I began to realize, and sorry, trying to bring it full circle, it's a little cloudy in my mind, but back to the VC thing, this health thing, that they were sort of saying, you kind of need to set your targets a little higher because actually depending on where you are on this sort of like return curve, right? That is not flat. It's not, just one single slope. That if you are at one of these inflection points or lower, then the good days can be sort of 10x and the bad days are, negative some amount. And if you're really low, what ends up happening is those negative amounts are sort of larger than the big amounts and you can sort of lose ground or, not move forward. Versus if you're higher up on the curve and you set your target, then even the low days, you're still sort of moving forward. And so when I talk about like learning or output at work, if you, sort of set your target as like my median is I get a little bit of good stuff done. And some days I get a lot, some days I don't, some days I make more work for myself by doing something stupid or saying something dumb at work, right? You kind of think about this as like evening out to like slow, small steps. But in reality, setting yourself up for at least some of those home runs. So setting yourself up positionally, but also just where your target is, like in how you expose yourself, it sort of drifts away. Sorry, my analogy is breaking, but like you sort of shift yourself into a position where you still have days that are below average, but your above average days give you this exposure opportunity for just outsized growth, right? You're taking those really, really hard home runs at work. You're going for just, really stretch opportunities and thinking about this, it's just an interesting thing I've been juggling with, which is I think a lot of myself included, a lot of the time I don't give myself this opportunity to have this sort of outperformance, this exposure, this VC 1000X, right? We talk about investment, you do the boring, everyone always says, just put all your money in the S&P 500 or the Russell 5000, just put all your money in there, this very averaged out return. But maybe some amount of it, maybe some small amount, you got to take those like really big swings and you got to limit it. But if it, 1000X, it could carry the whole portfolio.
Yeah. So I can riff on this. I mean, okay, so yeah. I don't know if I mentioned this in a past episode, but there's an awesome book from Nassim Nicholas Taleb, The Black Swan. Have you read The Black Swan?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm a big proponent that there are black swans and there are white swans. In other words, like there are
Wait, is white swan the opposite of black swan?
So, well, white swan's, okay, first of all, white swan is a term I literally just made up five seconds ago. But the way I would define it is like, you know, it's a unexpectedly high return.
Okay,
right?
Okay.
Because by definition, using your VC example, you know, the VC funds, I've heard things like they do 100 companies and they expect one company to make up for the other 99. So it's even more extreme. So what that means is if put yourself in the chair of a VC, when you talk to one of these 100 companies, you know, you're kind of expecting them to fail because, you know, statistically, they're going to be one of the 99, right? And at some point, you know, you figure out which one the one is, I'm sure. But I would consider that kind of like you're betting on a opposite of a black swan, like you're betting yep. on an unexpected, like huge boom, right? And so, yeah, I think that, you know, otherwise you wouldn't really take the risk, right? If there wasn't the opposite of a, let's call it the white swan, if the white swan wasn't there, the VC wouldn't do what they do, right? If one company, you know, 5x'd and the other 99 went to zero, that wouldn't work. So, so they're kind of counting on that. And I think that is kind of a good way to look at things. I think that there's sort of certain moments where you have kind of eureka moments, or you have kind of a burst, or you just get lucky. And so kind of budgeting for those kind of moments, I think makes a lot of sense. And being kind of ready to really capitalize. That's the other thing, is the VC hopefully is set up to where, you know, when they do find the one, that they can then, you know, 10x, triple down on that one. So same kind of thing. Like you're constantly kind of exploring. You see something pretty exciting, and then you kind of bet big on it. I do think that most returns are asymmetric. The other part I was going to say is, you know, your example with investing. You know, I think that at a large enough scale, things start to become normally distributed. Right. So in other words, like if Broadcom has like a killer year, well, it doesn't really matter if you've invested in, I don't know if they're in the S&P 500, but if you invested in all S&P 500, then their killer year gets sort of diluted. Right. So like at scale, you don't really have black swans or white swans, at least you hope, which is the reason why we can all be sort of comfortable, and we're not just anxiety ridden as we get older, right? So I think that at scale, when I think about investing as someone who's not a very savvy investor at all, you know, I just think, well, the returns are going to be normally distributed around 5% or 8% or whatever it is. But then individually, or when I look at things at a smaller scale, I do think the returns are often asymmetric.
Yeah, I think I might have mixed up sort of two things in my knowledge. So the one you riffed on is good. So I think there's like taking it to career growth, not that we always have to talk about that, but I actually believe, I was bringing this up the other day, most places we overestimate the impact of a failure. Like if your boss came and asked you, hey, do you want to try this like really hard thing? And you're like, I'm not sure. Yeah, what's really the downside of failing? Like, I think most of the time, in most cases, not all cases, you know, this is not universal advice. I'm not a lawyer, I guess. But like most cases, the risk of failing is pretty low. So it's actually really capped to the downside, you know, and it's, I guess, maybe similar to the VC example. The chance of the VC having money taken away from them is non-existent. So the worst case is capped at zero, but the top case is uncapped. So if they do really bad, if 100 out of 100 fail, they lose all their money that they invested, but it doesn't mean they invested all their money.
Correct.
But if one goes to Facebook scale or whatever, you know, then all of a sudden, you know, they're filthy rich. And so I think that's probably a good mapping. I think there's another thing I was trying to slide in there, but maybe now thinking about it, I muddied the water. I think it's separate, which is just like individual performance day to day. So like taking opportunities and getting that exposure, but then day to day trying to set yourself up so that you're getting the reps in, you're getting practice in, like you're getting yourself like training and skill and like setting your expectations for yourself maybe higher, knowing that sometimes you're not going to do as well, and then realizing when you practice being at a higher level that you're going to get similarly, it's not exactly the same though, I guess, but you're going to get those outperformance days, and those outperformance days may shock you with just, like, I've had that before. You call it kind of like eureka moment. You're like doing some work and being up at that higher level, you're going to potentially see more of them where it's just like, what was I thinking that day? Like, it was amazing. Like, how do I get that in a bottle? Like,
right,
I would
right.
love to be like that every day. And it doesn't happen often, but I do feel like it happens more often when I'm operating at a high, not burning out, but when I'm expecting more out of myself and performing at a high level.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that similar to the VC, you know, having that money to invest in the next round, like, you also need to balance your work and life so that when you do have like that eureka moment, you know, you can kind of really triple down on that and then go back to a more healthy state. So I think, I don't know if we have a term for this in my family, but there is kind of like this notion, like, oh, you know, dad's going into some work hole, you know, he's going to come back in like a couple of days or something.
I call it the fugue, but yeah.
The fugue?
Yeah, isn't that like an organ thing where like the organ music gets really loud and like, you know?
Oh, look
like,
at you. I've never, that's an SAT word I've never heard.
I have to look it up. Maybe, fugue state. Here we go, in music. Yeah, it's a fugue. Yeah. A fugue state is a disassociative, psychological, unexpected. Oh, wait, this is bad. No, this is like you have amnesia. What? Are you completely okay? Maybe I'm thinking. I guess I'm thinking.
Oh, fine. Patrick's going dementia again, girls.
Oh no! Oh no! Hang on. I don't know. Maybe I'm just using this wrong. Oh well, it's a word. Like you said, maybe you just needed to define a new word. It's like a flow state. That's what I think. You know. Anyways.
Okay. But yeah,
just made up a new word for it apparently because this doesn't match any existing definition. So. If you use this, don't expect anyone to know what it is.
You know, just, okay, kind of, maybe this is too much of a segue, but you made me think of another thing. I used to coach, high-level ICs at Facebook. So basically, obviously, like, I wasn't the highest level, so there's people above me and everything, but specifically, people who are trying to go either from 5 to 6 or 6 to 7, I did a bunch of one-on-one coaching, and then I ran this thing called the IC Circle, where we would just do more like one-to-many coaching, but it was more of like a community type thing. One thing really struck me: this person said they didn't want, this was one-on-one, they said they didn't want to go to level 6 because if you look at the stats, you're something like 15 times more likely to get fired if you're level 6 than if you're level 5, and for performance. And they're like, well, you know, I kind of want to take this promotion. They also were, I think they were on a visa. I mean, it's definitely part of it. But they just felt like, well, my expected value is 0 if I get fired. And so keeping that probability low is, I guess it's not 0. You get a job somewhere else. But I guess my point is, like, your expected value at Meta is 0 if they fire you. Right. So the raise, the level 6 compensation is higher, but not higher enough to justify that. Right. So anyway, what I told this person at the time was basically, you know, okay, I totally get it. I think there was kind of an issue with this, people at 6 and above just getting fired for performance. I said, but, you know, plan for the future, don't really plan for the present. It's like, okay, the present situation is you're looking around and you're seeing the level 6s on your team getting sent home, but that's, you can't kind of base the future on the present. And I think that you have to kind of like the asymmetric returns kind of kicks in where, you know, by taking that chance and getting that promotion now, you can always kind of figure out your steady state afterwards. What you can't do, or it's very hard to control, is having that amazing you know, product launch that causes you to get a promotion. Like, in other words, if you have an asymmetric return and you don't capitalize on it, it might be very, very hard to bounce back from that. But if you do capitalize on it, and then let's say worst case, you know, you get fired for performance at the next level, I still feel like that was the right call. And just to finish the story out, the person didn't get fired. They're actually still at Facebook, happily at their level.
So, I mean, this got talked about, not me, but by people in the field, financial people, when Facebook was doing the outsized bonuses for hiring AI people. I think they've turned it down now, but they were saying a little bit of a similar thing. There's an expectation of a continuing current state. So in other words, I don't have to take this right now because I could take it in 12 months or, you know, 24 months. And in reality, actually, it turned out it was like a window of like 30 days.
Yeah.
30 days or so. It was like really short. But it's sort of to what you were saying, those opportunities, you think they're going to come at some even spacing or always, and that's not right. It's not true. Your ability to get a promotion, your ability to be on that project, your ability to start something new, greenfield, make your mark, whatever, those things aren't evenly distributed in time. And so, I agree with you. All right. So cool. Just to follow up, I did find the correct definition of fuga. I wasn't that crazy, although it apparently have a slightly negative connotation, but it means to do something where you're completely aware and focused, but afterwards you can't remember what happened. And so
perfect. That's actually exactly what.
So actually, it took me a little bit of searching. Apparently it's a very deep back catalog definition, but.
It's like, what idiot wrote this code? And it was you a week ago?
Yes. Yeah. No, that's what you get really focused and you churn out all this stuff. My new one is writing code and then like having other people sort of help me like finish it off or whatever, and then submit it under their names. And then I think they wrote the code and they're like, no, you wrote this code. Oops. All right.
All right, time for news. You're up first.
All right, I'm up first. So it won't be this weekend when this comes out, but that's okay. Just recently, Andre Carpathy, I believe is how you say his name. Mm-hmm. You know, he's gained some renown recently for a little bit being the people's AI person, I guess. Like, you know, he's not running a big AI company. He clearly knows what he's doing. He can explain concepts, but he explains them in depth.
Well, let me add a little bit of color there. So Andre was the head of AI at Tesla, and he left, and he basically is like, I don't want to say retired, that's not the right word because he's very productive, but he quit to do exactly this, like to just build things for the people and teach the people. And so he's in a way like doing some monastic work right now.
Well, dude, talk about SAT words, monastic.
Oh, there we go. Look at this.
Monastery. Wow.
Man, you thought people thought they were coming here to talk about programming.
So, in some ways, actually, I think to your, thank you for that. Actually, that's color commentary is very good. You know, I think our podcast tries to be, although I don't say we're as effective as this, something in a similar vein, trying to break down stuff for folks. He released a new GitHub repo out of the blue. As far as I know, I didn't know he was working on it, called NanoChat. And NanoChat is, previously he had done some other sort of examples of training, I don't want to say like toy, but like toy transformer networks and models and getting them up to sort of GPT-2 level, sort of, you know, ChatGPT-2 level. Like, it's just better than if you remember. Oh, I don't know. A while ago, a decade ago, people were doing hidden Markov models trained on, you know, Harry Potter, and it would produce words that, like, if you didn't look too closely, they kind of look like maybe sentences, but they didn't make any sense. And then, you know, we kind of got into the chat GPTs. These GPTs were good. So he's sort of done some of that before, but now sort of what he's done is done an end-to-end pre-training, doing the chat UI, you know, constructing the models and everything end to end in a single repo. So you can really kind of study it. And really awesomely, if you don't know, training the frontier models, I don't even know what the estimates are now, like $10 million to train, to train one. They're very, very, very expensive. So most training outside of the maybe 10 companies in the world is doing fine tuning, you know, other small things, but not the sort of pre-training. That's reserved for people have much more money to burn than myself.
And 10 million, I think, just is one instance. So it's like, if you miss a colon, I mean, you're going to catch earlier than that. But like in theory, if you have some data issue, now it's another 10 million.
Yeah. You know, who knows how many times they have to do it. Yeah, that's right. And that was a big thing, if you recall, DeepSeek getting really popular for, you know, they were had their moment. They've kind of, you know, taken a little step back, you know, in terms of in the, you know, general awareness. But that was their big thing, was doing some of this pre-training cheaper. Okay. Anyways, back to the story. So Andre's Carpathy's repo also made it so that you could do all of this for $100. Now, $100 isn't nothing, but I'll make a couple observations. So first one is, again, compared to that other amount, people spend more than that. Go play a round of golf, you know, go do some, you know, it is a lot of money. I don't want to diminish it, but it is enough. Like if you're doing it for learning, if you're doing it for understanding, if you're, you know, really getting into this, it's attainable. It's a hobbyist level amount that you could spend, which is awesome on sort of relatively reasonable spec hardware. And he has the scripts for doing all of it sort of set up, which is really awesome. But then, of course, the second observation I'll make is twofold. One, the cost for his stuff will go down if you wait, you know, 6 months, 12 months. I would expect it to be cheaper as new hardware and instances and supply come online. But the second thing is, as a general sort of observation, a lot of this stuff, this is where you're seeing the growth. You know, we're not seeing ChatGPT, whatever, 5 or any of these other things become 2x better, 3x better. Like, it's not really happening, but the cost to train, the cost to run inference is all coming down dramatically. And here, you know, I think is a little bit of an example of, you know, sort of the rise in the hobbyist stuff and the decline of the cost, you know, coming to, you know, not exactly a meeting point, but coming and converging together to where we can start to not get to state of the art, but push to something that 5 years ago would have been like, oh my gosh, like you did all of this, right? That would be crazy. So it's a reminder of the insane progress we're seeing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think it's a really good, good kind of recap. Yeah, I mean, this stuff's super exciting. I think a lot of the innovation now is, and I think Andrej actually talks about this, is around, you know, reverse engineering the best possible prompt. I don't know if I brought this up, but
I don't think we have.
I had a situation at my current job about a month or two ago. We changed models. So a model that we were using was deprecated. And so we moved on to the next version of the same model. And the performance went way, way down, like really, really far down. Like it went from maybe 80% to 7% kind of thing. And after a lot of debugging and kind of, you know, looking at a lot of numbers, we realized that all we had to do was change the... So we had a prompt that was about 3 or 4 sentences in a paragraph. If we swapped the first 2 sentences, the performance went back to 80%. So basically, like, the ordering of the sentences, the way the thoughts are... And it's not like... It wasn't illogical the first way, right? It was 2 independent thoughts. And they just... If you switch the order, massive improvement. And so what that says to me is... that we humans shouldn't be writing these prompts. I mean, you know, we write the first version, but like at the bare minimum, you know, we should have a system that just like reorders them a few different ways and picks the best ordering, like somehow breaks them into independent thoughts and then tries different permutations. But at the limit, it would be, you know, some type of feedback mechanism that's constantly updating all of these prompts. But that, I think, is where I'm seeing kind of a lot of the innovation. And I think it's because of cost. Exactly, you know, as you said, when it costs $10 million to train a model, what we ultimately need, and I think NanoChat's a good way of getting there, is, you know, a set of benchmarks and a set of models that are small and trained for very cheap. And then you can, you know, learn some insight. Someone can invent the next thing. Right? Like maybe it's SSMs, maybe it's diffusion chat models, right? Someone invents the next thing and then it blows everything else out of its weight class, but it's still nowhere near ChatGPT, but it totally dominates the very cheap ChatGPT. And so then you could say, okay, this is now worth spending $10 million.
I mean, I guess that's partly where I think the running local models, you know, on your whatever home smart device, your personal assistant on your phone, we were just checking before briefly, there's a, you know, cloud outage this morning. So that happens from time to time. And so I think having some of these models run locally, and I think when the hardware gets sophisticated enough and the models get distilled enough to be like absolutely actually useful in those things, I bet you see a lot more investment into that as like a focused product that you can have. Like, what is state of the art for a capped size model, not unbounded?
Right. Yeah, exactly. All right. My news article is Pydantic AI. To be totally honest, I picked a random news article. I really just wanted to talk about Pydantic AI. I could have made it a tool, but I had a different tool. So this is really cool. I used this the other day. I built a very simple test, like a prototype. So I downloaded, remember PC Part Picker?
Yes.
Remember that website? Yeah. I don't know if they're still around, but someone posted basically CSV files of all the inventory of PC Part Picker. So there's a CSV file for heat sinks, a CSV file for processors, et cetera, et cetera. And I use Pydantic AI, which is this way to build AI agents, which we should probably do an entire show on, but it's taking off, and I think it's very interesting. And I only give it access to one tool, and the tool is, you know, DuckDB? We've probably talked about this, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the tool literally is, you can, you pass in which CSV file you're interested in, video card, CPU, etc., and a DuckDB SQL query. And this AI tool opens that CSV, runs a query, returns back the results. And so that was it. And so this whole AI agent thing with Pydantic AI, it was like 80 lines of code or something. And now I have this thing where you can ask it to build you computers. Like, you can literally type in, hey, I want a computer with the NVIDIA GPU, at least 16 gig of VRAM for under $2,000. And it will actually build a computer for you out of all those parts. And it runs SQL queries, and you can actually see all the steps. Like, first it runs like a describe select on each of the CSV files so it can get all the schemas of them all. And then it starts running queries. Sometimes it'll type in a query that doesn't compile. DuckDB will like send an error back, and Pydantic can will actually catch errors and turn them into strings and send those strings back to the AI. So the AI like got an error and was like, oh, I need to change the query. And it did. And it eventually gets there, and it generates like builds PCs that are good. So, but I just found this amazing, and I'm sure there are other tools out there, but I couldn't believe how in just a matter of hours I was able to go from nothing to all that.
That is really cool. And it's really, I mean, like commoditizing. Like, yeah, it's coming to the fact that, yeah, we can do that, and it's super cool.
Yeah. So if you're doing agentic stuff, this is the same company that made Pydantic, which is a data class system that's very popular and really well done. Actually, it's the same people made SQL model and Fast API and like a ton of amazing libraries. So this is also, you know, walking in good footsteps.
My next news article is something that I actually botched, and then it was amazing how it was amazing before it was amazing. Okay, here we go. So I saw this news article, and it was 1,000th Starlink after a launch this weekend from SpaceX. So all the Starlink satellites up, and it's been actually a huge thing, like the amount of money they're making. It's a private company still, you know, owned by SpaceX, but the number of subscribers they have, like as far as like a tech story, it's actually really astonishing. Would love to would invest. It's private, so it's a bit of a thorny issue to try to get access. But this is a great idea. I'm really for it. But you know, saw this. I was talking about it that, you know, there's 1,000 satellites, and then I was like, wait a minute. Hang on, let me look at this again. And it's, you know, oh, it was 1,000 Starlink satellites had been launched in 2025 so far. So
yeah,
what I thought was crazy. Like, yeah, what I already thought was amazing is like, oh, there's 1,000 of these satellites, you know, orbiting around. How cool is this? It's like, no, that's incorrect. There's been 1,000 launched to this year. So then I, wait a minute, how many are there? And it's like 8,400 and something in orbit. There are so many in orbit now that actually every single day, 1 to 2 Starlink satellites incinerate back into the atmosphere from sort of end of lifing, which is expected. So they put them into, you know, relatively low Earth orbit. So their orbits, you know, there's a little bit of air friction, whatever, they naturally decay. They're meant to do that. You don't want them staying up forever and, you know, getting obsolete and then just drifting around as space junk. So I actually think they do a process for, you know, intentionally sort of making it so they'll deorbit, you know, deliberately rather than just, you know, chaotically. But basically, there have been so many gone up and going up that 1 to 2 every single day are just basically burning up. And it's still this like insanely lucrative business doing all this crazy stuff. And there are 8,000. Found a visualizer you can click and actually see all of them, because there's, you know, sort of orbit information is known. And it turns out orbital mechanics is like well understood. So you can actually just go and visualize the entire like mesh of all of the orbits, which is very well planned to get nice coverage. You can see new ones that are being deployed are like clustered together and slowly drift to their, I guess, station. I'm not familiar with the term, but it's absolutely bonkers just to think about the scale of this. And I don't think maybe I've talked about it on the podcast before, but I was talking about it with some local friend group, you know, just sort of how, if you had said this, you know, whatever, 10 years ago, like, oh yeah, there's like this Starlink thing. It's roughly competitive with broadband. It works great. You can play video games on it. Like, it's not super laggy. It's in this little dish, this, you know, flat dish thing. And people would be like, what? No, that. And then now people are like, yeah, of course, that's called Starlink. Like, I have that in my cabin.
Yeah, so, it's from, do they have coverage in the ocean? How does that work? Is it the kind of thing where it's only in places where that can be populated? Or is it literally circumnavigating?
They have slightly different fee structure. I'm not clear if it's because they can or because there's a reason. But no, people have it on like their ships, on their traveling RVs, on their boats. Yeah. This weekend or whatever, they're demoing, and I guess maybe some people still don't know this, but there was like a couple weekends ago or whatever, they were talking about one of the airlines, I want to say United or American here in the United States, was going to be putting Starlink dishes on all of the planes, which they've used a different satellite provider. So if you've ever gotten satellite on an airplane, it's, you know, it's not very good. But now they were like flying this reporter up and sort of, they were able to take a FaceTime call and it felt like normal. And they were like, from an airplane? And they were just like, their mind was sort of like blown that, you know, flying through space. I think Elon Musk even ended up retweeting about it. And he's like, well, if you're traveling, whatever the orbital speed, I won't quote it because I'll get it wrong, of a Starlink satellite, he's like, even airplanes look basically still. And so, you
that
know,
makes
you
sense.
Flying through an airplane, like, oh my gosh, it's moving so fast. Aren't there going to be all of this? And he's like, no, they basically look like they're standing still because we're flying so fast.
Wow, that's incredible.
And so it's just this interesting sort of normalization of what is just absolute, it's rocket science, right? Like just all of this stuff, you know, being up there and going around is
do they great. So when the Starlink satellites are you know shuttled, is that shuttle reusable or like how does that work?
Yeah, so they do the Falcon 9. So if it comes back and lands normally on the barge, so they go up, launch it in the second stage, the top part of the rocket as a fan go up, and they don't relaunch that. That's the new thing, the really big one that they make a big deal out of Texas, the Starship and the booster that goes with that. The full thing is supposed to be reusable. So that's like where they see the future. But for now, the first stage, which has most of the, you know, more of the rocket engines and everything, basically goes up and then comes back and lands. And those are the videos you see. And so that's why they're able to put, well, part of why they're able to put so many satellites up in orbit. But they still, there is some portion of the launch vehicle that doesn't get reused.
Got it. Makes sense. Cool. All right. My second news story is the introduction of the apps in ChatGPT and the ChatGPT apps SDK. I feel like this is really powerful. I feel like there's something here. So just to explain at least how I think of it, because it's still very early, basically, and I don't have a lot of details on it yet. I don't think they even kind of have a lot of details yet themselves. But the way I imagine this working is, you know, let's say you ask ChatGPT to play your favorite song, or you ask it to buy eggs from well, I guess if you say from, let's say buy eggs from Walmart, right? So right now, if you do that, you know, ChatGPT is going to say, hey, I can't do any of these things. Would you like me to do something else? It's always so polite. It's like, would you like me to just talk to you about eggs? But, you know, in the future with these apps, you know, you will install the Walmart app. And when you ask a question, you know, the OpenAI folks will figure out from your question whether they should route that question to an app or not. And if they decide they should, it gets routed. And now Walmart, you know, which probably is using ChatGPT anyways, but like now Walmart gets your question and they're poised to handle it differently. So for example, if Walmart gets your question, they could order the eggs. They, you know, they have your identity from you being logged into ChatGPT. And so they can order the eggs and eggs show up at your house the next day, which is pretty cool. I do feel like this is kind of like a new kind of app store moment, which is pretty exciting. I do feel like we'll kind of look back on this and say, oh, like I wish I'd built like the, you know, whatever the most obvious app is, maybe groceries is it, I don't know. But I feel like now is the time to think about like, what is the app that obviously everybody wants? Because apps aren't even allowed on the store yet. I think they're going to announce a date when you can start submitting apps. But you have access to the SDK. So if you have something where you think chat would be a better experience than going on the web or whatever else you would do, now's the time to build that thing so that as soon as they announce the submission process, you could be first in line. I do think there's something just extraordinarily powerful here.
When this was launched, I saw it was like 1,000 startups are killed by one slide or something. It was like the headline. But I guess maybe I like the way you explain it, I guess, if you develop your app, it's sort of like now you can host your own like server if you do something local and your chat agent can query your, you know, local server that's answering something. So it's like sort of chat, you do some training or upload some workflow or something, and then OpenAI will route ChatGPT queries to that internally if you host something there. Like, if you, is the state in their ecosystem? Can you run arbitrary code?
So,
I guess not completely clear.
Yeah, let me see if I can explain it. So the idea is, you know, you submit an app, OpenAI approves it. Now you're on their app store, right? So a person who uses ChatGPT installs your app, right? Now, when that person asks questions to OpenAI, OpenAI can route some of those questions to you, and you could then use OpenAI as part of helping, you know, answer the question. But they're now expecting you to respond with an answer. So
in the case, like you said, so you're a grocery store, you do work to make sure that like your OpenAI app knows how to call yours inventory and pricing, you know, REST API. And so you give all of that information or whatever to your subcomponent app. And then, and then the user installs that one, which is why it doesn't have to disambiguate across every app on the app store. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so you can also build tools like I talked about with the Pydantic AI. So in addition to being sort of so open-ended that ChatGPT just calls you with a string of text, you can also have a tool. So for example, maybe you have a buy groceries tool, and that tool takes like some very specific structured data. So like the name of the grocery and how, what quantity and all of that. I mean, you still have to do all the validation yourself because you don't never know what ChatGPT is going to call your tool with, but at least that might be more structured than, you know, you just have a string of text and have to figure out what to do with that.
Very cool.
Yeah, definitely check this out. I mean, I feel like folks out there, you know, especially if you're a hobbyist, this is like something to get in on early, I feel.
Yeah, I guess that's the dozen fart apps on the App Store that made, you know, tons of money in the first year of the Apple App Store.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You need the equivalent, the fart GPT. I don't know. Never mind. This is just devolve. Let's not do
chart GPT.
No, stop. Oh boy. All right, let's just move to book of the show.
We'll have to get rid of the friendly tag or whatever, the safe for work tag.
I don't think we have a friendly anyways, my book of the show, just hard pivoting segue, forcing a segue, is I'm repeating The Will of the Many. I had this book, I believe, a couple episodes ago. I had only just started it. I have finished it. It was really good. I really like it. So I felt like I owed the people the like follow-up, that if I was going to pitch it as a, you know, hey, I'm starting this book, it seems kind of interesting. I did finish it. It is good, you know. And the second one comes out probably by the time this episode's out, it'll sort of be out. So if you haven't started this book and it sounded interesting from my last pitch, I guess I could repitch it, but you know, definitely has like an equivalent of kind of a magic system, a loose magic system, where people can sort of seed their something called like a will, like sort of part of their like energy, their life energy, I guess, hasn't been, you know, fully explained yet, and they can sort of give it to somebody else, and those are assembled into the government in a kind of form of a hierarchy, a pyramid, and it's all about sort of the dynamics, the politics of that. And so, of course, you know, a story about a boy who's an orphan and ends up getting, you know, sucked up into intrigue and mystery and all of that good stuff, but by the author James Islington, who I've recommended other books from before. Definitely something that I would recommend now, having finished it. And I'm looking forward to the next one. I guess I could have made it my book of the show, but the next one seems like it's going to be really good as well. And I'm looking forward to reading that.
All right. Yeah, I'll definitely have to check that out. I need to get more into reading fiction. My book of the show is actually a podcast episode. I'm cannibalizing our show here, but basically, I had a long drive. So long story short, it was just me and the boys, me and my two sons, and we were driving to Houston and back. And, you know, they're playing, you know, Nintendo Switch or whatever they want to do. So I'm like, I'm gonna listen to a podcast. And I listened to the whole 6 hours of this podcast with DHH, who's the person who made Ruby on Rails. I thought it was fascinating, actually. I kind of went in thinking, well, you know, this is somebody I have kind of heard about. A friend of mine told me we should have DHH on our show. That would be kind of cool. DHH, if you happen to be listening, which I doubt, but or somebody who knows him or something, totally down for that. But you know, I'd heard of him, and I remember specifically him posting a lot about getting off of the cloud, and he ended up moving to like a colo. So, you know, I thought it'd be kind of interesting, but I had, honestly, a little bit low expectations of just any podcast episode where it's just kind of a one-sided where the person just basically talks for 6 hours. But I was like blown away, actually. I felt like the content was really interesting. Actually, the whole, it really goes against a lot of the sort of like common themes that you're seeing a lot of. So for example, DHH like despises going into any office. And so he's like, you know, remote work is the only work. It's a really interesting perspective. You know, he talks about how to make remote work work well. He's been doing this for like decades, right? So he gives a lot of perspective on that. The company, which I think is called 27 Signals, they took $0 of funding. So they basically bootstrapped themselves by doing contract work. they did contract work until they had kind of enough money. And I guess they structured the contract work in such a way where they could share the IP and then eventually open source the IP, and it became Ruby on Rails and all of that. So $0 of venture, $0 of anyone investing. And he said something kind of interesting. He said, you know, people gave me a hard time because they say, well, you know, you, their product, which I forgot the name. Oh, Basecamp. So their product is Basecamp, which is similar to Jira. And people say, look, you could have made Jira. You know, your product is actually like in many ways better than Jira. And Atlassian is like a giant company and you're this tiny company. And his response was interesting. It's basically like, it's a tiny company, but you know, I own half of it. And like Jason, who's his co-founder, owns the other half. And actually like owning 50% of a tiny company is awesome. And I have more than enough money and all of that. And it was like a real kind of like, I guess like it is also like, I keep wanting to think of the word monastic, but it is kind of like totally antithetical to everything you see on social media. Everything on social media is, look at this big round we raised. You know, no one ever says, look at this $30 million we raised. We only had to give up, you know, 70% of the company. Like no one ever says that part of it, right? And everyone seems to be just extolling all the virtues of being in person. I feel like just to have a different perspective, it was pretty mind-blowing. So I highly recommend folks listen to it. Also, you know, my dad was a race car driver, so he spends about an hour or two talking about race car driving, which, you know, hits close to home, which I loved hearing about. That's a more of a personal thing, but I found the whole interview fascinating, and I'd highly recommend folks check it out. And it's 6 hours, so I think it counts as a book.
Fair enough. Yeah, I think 37 signals is private. I've looked before, I was just looking in to see, but I guess one of those interesting things about private versus public, and to your point, not only they have a lot more discretion, like it just don't have to share a lot of information and get judged about decisions. And so because he doesn't have investors or all of this, like even people, you know, hear some Hacker News post and they're just saying like, can we even estimate how many subscribers they have, how much money? And people are like throwing out numbers, but they're all, you know, just speculation or you know, based on some, you know, sort of swag at it. Like they're not accurate. And it's just kind of interesting to think about like the amount of stress reduction that would give to someone to say, we're just going to make the decision. Can we continue to pay the people who work for us? Can we continue to make money that we're happy with? And like, there's always that question, like, what's enough? You know, and like, if you don't have an answer to what's enough, then maybe you just end up in one of these quests to, you know, seek power and fame and fortune. And that's okay, I guess. But if you can say this is enough, and he is saying, you know, I can do these really cool things, drive race cars and have this business that doesn't make me hate my life, then, you know, that is awesome. It's great to see, like you said, sort of another way instead of it only that there's only one way.
Yeah. I mean, somebody said, the host of the podcast said, you know, hey, you know, one thing about working remote is, you know, it's kind of lonely. How do you deal with that? How do you meet people? And the guy was like, DHH is like, get married, have a family. He's like, yeah, I have kids running around the house. I'm never lonely. You know, it's like, these are the kind of things that like, just a different perspective. Like I've never heard anyone give an answer like that. And, you know, it's so different. I'm still honest. I mean, we just got back from Houston. So I haven't had a lot of time to really like sleep on this, but it's such a different perspective that I have to really think about it. But I think there's definitely nuggets of wisdom there. Absolutely. And I do feel like, you know, I've kind of ping-ponged between, you know, I was in the office, COVID hit, I worked remote for, 4 years? Now I've been in the office for the past year. And I do actually feel like, I feel like remote is better in many ways. But it has to be done correctly and you have to be in the right situation. So I think remote where there is an office and like 90% of the people are in it, I think that's hard. Of course, you can make it work. But I think socially, like it takes a lot of, you have to be very active. on managing that. I think remote, where everyone's remote or in the office, you know, it's you're on Zoom all the time anyways, because there's always, this is my perspective. Everyone's remote because you go into the office, but there's the Seattle office, or there's Bob who's remote. Like as soon as you have more than one office or a single person in the company who's remote, now you're remote because you're on Zoom all day anyways.
I guess my thought here is similar to what I was saying before. I don't think there's one right way. I think, to your point, it's situational, it's company by company, it's person by person. Some people hate, like, I couldn't be at home, it's noisy. Other people like, I can't stand the office, it's noisy, people dropping in on you. Like, it's, you know, for almost any statement, someone will say the same statement in positive and negative light.
Yeah.
And so, like anything, my thought is, you're going to have to try really hard to prove that there's a singular right answer and no nuance. Anytime someone comes and says, remote work is the worst, it doesn't make sense, it never works. Or if someone says, and the office is dumb, it never works, we should all be remote. Like, whenever you make a statement with no wiggle room, those are always the hardest to defend, right? And it's, yeah, like, come on, there's got to be a gradient here. And, you know, and if there's a gradient, I think that, you know, I will say, even being people fully in the office, having the setup that we could do fully remote means people have some flexibility to do, if they need to take a week, they may have taken a sick week or something away, or they needed to, you know, I was pointing out, be home. There's so much random stuff where people expect you to be at your place of living for delivery or for some improvement or to come in or whatever, and then they change the date. So having some flexibility to handle those situations has been a net benefit, regardless of sort of what percentage allocation you spend office or at home.
Yeah, totally makes sense. All right.
Tool of the show. Oh man, I think I'm losing my voice. It's not good. All right. Mine is a game, and it's a game I am almost certain I didn't look because I didn't want to know, but I'm almost certain that I've recommended before. It's everyone knows it, everyone has it, but I don't care because I got sucked back in. I was free, and then I am no longer free. I've been playing Factorio again, and not even, although it looks amazing, not even the Space Age DLC. I'm just back to playing vanilla base, no mod, Factorio. I've been playing it on my Switch, and it's always like a little awkward. It's so much better on the PC with the keyboard, I will admit. But once you get into the groove and you're like on an airplane, which I was recently a couple times, you know, can sit on the couch with the family, you know, when they're watching some show you just really don't want to watch for the fifth time in a row, which whatever. Anyways, like if you can quote the show and like you know what's going to happen from the kids show, you know you've seen it too many times, which means seen it even more than you, because you know you haven't watched it every time they've watched it.
Yep.
Anyways, I'm sucked back in. Factorio, if you've not played it, you either are going to assume it is either going to be work or amazing, or you won't understand it. I guess those are the three outcomes. Be like, this is just like work, it sucks, I don't want to work. Or you're gonna go, I don't get it, this is like weird and just like, this is not fun. Or you're gonna be like, what? Yeah, fugue. You're gonna spend 10 hours, right, and then you have no clue what happened.
You know, I posted about a month ago, I had a friend, a close friend, who's trying to grow his Twitter presence and just actively trying to do this. And he posted saying, you know, I went from 1,300 followers to 7,000 followers in a month. Here's a list of things I did. And it was a list of things. And I replied and I was like, how I went from 1,300 followers to 1,300 followers in 3 years. And it was a screenshot of Factorio. But Factorio is amazing. I mean, it's so satisfying. It's like got to be one of the most satisfying feelings, like building a factory.
I have a confession. I have played probably, I don't want to look how many hours. I don't actually, maybe the Switch does track. I don't know how to look. It's not prominent like on Steam. So I'm not sure how many hours I played. I've never launched a rocket.
What? Really?
Is that bad? It's bad, right? I need to do it. It's become like a goal. Like before I stop this time, I have to do it. I just always do other stuff. I don't know.
Wow, that's amazing, though. Actually, it's amazing that like you have built all these intrinsic rewards, you know? It's like, oh, can I? Well, like, well, give us an example of something that took you a long time that wasn't rocket.
No, it's not. No, no, it's worse than that. I play for a while. I start to get to like a good, and it reaches like, there's always some place, and it's always a little different where it you need to like do a bunch without like a good progression. So you can like progress early game, progress. And I'm getting better, I think, actually, each time. And then I go away for a while. I'm like, I don't have time to invest to like double my output here, build another one of these, or, you know, get a blueprint working or get the bots going. So I just like, I put it away for a while or I get busy. And then I come back. I'm like, I don't remember where anything is. So I just start a new game. And then I just like start over, and I just like do with all the improvements. So it's just like, whatever you call it, like greasing the groove. Like I just keep playing the early game over and over again. I know,
that makes sense. That makes sense.
It's bad. I'm a bad person. Like I need to finish the game. There's so much the developer put in I haven't even experienced.
My kids play with a creative mode where you're not even a person. You could just build anything anywhere and it's unlimited. And you kind of like teleport around the map and they just build random things with it.
I turn the biters, like the biters are there, but they won't attack you unless you attack them because I don't know. It's too anxiety inducing, man.
Well, you know, I mean, you probably know this, but the construction robots just totally changed the profile of the game. Like, I have mine, like near the end game, mine will be set up where I'll have basically stamps that like stamp an entire screen's worth of content. And so it's like, like four robo ports, a bunch of these like, electric towers, and then a bunch of solar panels, and it just stamps down. And then because the robo ports are part of the stamp, you know, it builds the robo ports and then it can build the next stamp. And so I'll just walk across the screen stamping like hundreds of these. And then I'm like done with power. It's like, okay, well, I'm don't have to think about power for the rest of the game.
Nice.
All right. My tool of this show is nip.io, which is apparently a great way to get in trouble at work. As
yeah, I still have no clue what this is.
So this is like, I could see why workplaces wouldn't like this, but I'll explain what the tool is. So the idea is, there are many places where, you know, you can't use just an IP address. You have to use a host name. And so you end up in your code writing all these things like, oh, if I'm local, then use like this IP address, otherwise use this host name. Or you end up in weird situations where, like if you're running on Kubernetes, you know, then the host you want to talk to is just called database, and you can like ping database, you know, curl database, like from the other nodes in that Kubernetes cluster. But then when you're not running in Kubernetes, now it's like, oh no, it's actually localhost. It gets all confusing. Right. And so this nip.io is like a cool way to turn any IP address into a DNS. So basically, you take the IP address, whatever it is, you know, 1.1.1.1, and then you add .nip.io at the end. And now you have a DNS, but it's going to resolve to exactly that IP address. So, you know, you're kind of trusting. So I will say that for the reason probably is blocked for Patrick's job is that you're kind of trusting these people to convert that DNS to the correct IP address. So, you know, you might put in like 2.2.2.2.nip.io and it resolves to 2.2.2.2 because the people behind that website have built like a DNS lookup that does that. But they could change that code tomorrow. They could make it so everything.nip.io goes to Google or goes to a web-based Bitcoin miner or whatever like that. So that is sort of a vulnerability that you're taking on. It is, you know, it's powered by a company that seems like pretty reputable, but that is a risk. But you know, when you're doing debugging stuff, especially locally on your laptop, or you're getting started with a new project, it could be an easy kind of convenience. Yeah. That's my tool of the show. I have not used
it before, but I could see, yeah, like you said, there are specific use cases where it would be really useful.
Yeah, totally. There's a lot of code, I mean, especially third-party code that expects a domain name that just will not take an IP address, and this is a way to get around it. All right. So, go ahead.
No. Anyways. Workflow orchestrator.
We're going to orchestrate the show here with a workflow orchestrator.
I'm distracted today, dude. We're just like, barrel forward.
We're going to just fuge this.
Fugue.
We're going to fugue it.
I'm never living that down.
It's all fugued up over here. Okay, let's talk about why you need a workflow orchestrator. So here's a very simple example. And actually, kind of spoiler alert, I actually asked this as my interview question. So if you ever end up getting interviewed by me, you're going to probably get this question. Let's say you're building, YouTube, and specifically, like, don't worry about like the social networking or any of that, but just, you upload a video, it transcodes your video 100 different ways for mobile and, low bandwidth and all of that. And then when other people go to that URL, they get your video. So video is maybe not the best example of this because it takes a while to upload the video. But, you upload the video and, then it has to go through and do a whole bunch of work, right? That transcoding of that video to other formats, maybe you uploaded it as a QuickTime video, which, they don't want to serve that on the web, right? So that is a time-intensive process. And so it's not practical to like just have someone wait on a web request, right? Because if that person just hits F5 or something and closes the connection, how is that going to work, right? There's kind of two problems here. Problem number one is sometimes you have to do things that take a long time. And then problem number two is sometimes you have to do things that are kind of non-interactive where someone will leave and you need this thing to keep working and eventually report back in some way. The last category of why you'd need this would be, you have a lot of things, a huge batch of things that you need to do. So for example, this is a very real example for us. I went through and transcribed all of the episodes of Programming Throwdown. So if you look at the transcriptions, they're better than they were before. The old system I was using was massively out of date, and I felt like, well, since I upgraded it, I might as well just re-transcribe everything. And so, we have 180 some odd episodes, 184 episodes, and so. That actually is expensive, but even if it wasn't, it's a batch job that I have to just submit 100 of these and just tell me when they're all done, right? So that's the basic reason why you'll want to use a workflow orchestrator. Under the hood, they all work more or less the same way. So there's a set of message queues, and so I think we've talked about PubSub and these things in the past, but basically. You need a way to submit jobs, and the jobs need a way to read your submission. And so there needs to be some kind of queue to handle that. If the job is multi-step, then when the first step is done, now, a new thing needs to be pushed onto this message queue saying, okay, we're ready for the second step, right? A job can fail, like AWS could shut down that machine, the hard drive could fail on that machine, et cetera, et cetera. And so message queues are important for, there's a lot of logic around, basically you send a keep alive to the queue while you're still alive. And if the queue doesn't get a keep alive for some amount of time that you specify, let's just say 10 minutes, it assumes that you're dead and it will rerun, like it will ask another machine to go and process that. So message queue is a big part of it, and containerization, another really big part of it, because you need a way to define some task on your computer, but then ultimately send that task out to the cloud. And there might be hundreds, maybe thousands, tens of thousands of machines kind of running your task. And so it's not practical to like sudo apt-get install some package all those times. So there needs to be some type of containerization. And then also the workflow. So the thing that, you know, tells, you know, the overall system what tasks need to be run and which ones depend on which other ones, you know, that also needs to be put in the cloud somewhere and containerized. And so that's the second ingredient. And the third and final ingredient is some type of worker pool. So some type of, a pool of machines that are ready to do work. And you typically pair this with some type of auto scaling. So if you have, especially if you have bursty work. So imagine, YouTube is such a multinational thing that this wouldn't happen. But imagine if you were building a version of YouTube and you're just getting started where it's maybe way more popular in the US. You'd want to scale those nodes down when it's the wee hours in our time zones and then scale them up when it's peak hours.
Yeah, I think that becomes important too for, you know, something going viral. So if your website goes viral, you want to capture the signups, you want to capture whatever, right? So, but I think in that case, if the things people are signing up are doing are kicking off these workflows, I wanted to circle back to, you know, talking about failures, but I think there's a couple of things maybe that are less obvious or maybe important about these. So one is you were mentioning, you know, something like YouTube size, but when you're kind of small, things generally fail because you did something wrong or there's a bug or a problem. But when you reach a certain size, even if, you know, if you look at what I guess is called mean time between failure, like you said, a hard drive or cosmic ray or whatever it may be. But when you're running a million, you know, jobs a day, what is the chance that at least one job is gonna, you know, have an issue in a day? It's non-trivial, right? It's noticeable. And so you're getting these failures because someone is walking into the server room and pulling out a server rack and like blowing the dust out of it for maintenance or whatever, right? And you can either have that be very carefully planned or just say, look, it's going to get handled. And I think kind of that is the same vein as you see stuff like, I think Netflix was famous for doing Chaos Monkey, something that goes in and just basically kills off nodes or drop nodes to make sure, you know, nothing breaks. It just randomly sows chaos. I think that was
my job when I was there.
that is my job in my family. I'm just a chaos monkey. Oh, dad's here. Okay. Wow. I'm distracted today. The other thing is, you know, we were talking about, you know, and I think we'll get to it in a minute, but something like training an LLM and it's, you know, $10 million. Some of these workflows could be very, very, very expensive. And like you said, imagine there's some error, but imagine the error occurs at like a very late stage. You don't want to start all the way again from the beginning. So being able to kind of, it's not exactly hot swap, but being able to resume the pipeline with a new version of like a later node, or even you just, maybe it's not an error, maybe the whole thing finishes, but then you realize, oh, here in this last stage or this last, but we could do better, or we could do something different. So having a system that automatically is like preserving those stages and inputs and you know that kind of stuff so you can sort of rerun later parts becomes like super useful, and tying that all with a dashboard and management, which is things I have seen people not use one of these, and then you end up just basically reinventing them. So you can either like not use them, or you can reinvent one with half the features that you like do yourself, and you just slowly try to rebuild a crappier version of like an existing solution.
Yeah, totally agree. Yeah, I think the part you mentioned about history and backfill is super important. Like there have been so many times where exactly what you said happens. You know, the job runs successfully, but it wasn't actually a success. Like we actually went the past 3 days with no artifacts because maybe the upload failed, but it didn't let the job know that something was wrong. So for example, like a very common pattern is where you catch an error in Python or in any language, you catch the error and then log an error message. And that's great and all, but because you caught the error and you didn't bubble it all the way up, now your job thinks it finished successfully. Like if you didn't set the exit code correctly on your program. And so, you know, that can happen. And then you find out about it. Even if you find out about it an hour later, if your website's popular enough, that could be millions of jobs that have run in that hour that need to be rerun. So having all of that ledger and then being able to backfill and say, okay, you know, all the jobs from, 3 days ago to now, I need to rerun all of them. And it just goes through and does that and auto scales to handle it, all that. There's sort of this, it's kind of like, you know how cars have the, there's basically like a backup system. So imagine on your HUD, imagine your HUD just like disappears, like the OS powering the heads up display on your car fails. It's got some kind of backup where you'll at least see like the miles per hour or something. But now that, yeah, right. But that contingency, that's what I was thinking of. There's a contingent operating system in most of these cars. But now that contingent operating system, that really needs to not fail, right? Because now you're really hosed. And so similarly here, you know, the workflow orchestrator itself, if it starts failing, that can be a really difficult thing to survive, right? And so to your point, you know, I've seen it as well where people try to build their own, and it happens so innocently. You know, the way it happens is, you have some task, and this happens at big companies, you know, so it's not a small company thing specifically. Like you have some task and it's relatively minor. And so you have this script that does it. And, that starts to succeed. So it's like, well, you know, I'm just going to make a cron job and have it run this Python script every hour. And then it's like, oh, okay, now I need to run it, you know, every minute. Oh, now I need like three machines. So I'll just spin up three EC2 instances all running this Python script every minute. And you kind of like, at some point, you have to just eat the technical debt and like set up a workflow orchestrator. But I've seen too many cases where people kind of go too long. And then when there is an issue, it becomes very difficult.
I think the other term you'll hear with a lot of these is DAG, which isn't unique to these, but that all of these jobs form a directed ASIC, like no cycle graph. So they're not looping. So they have a start, they process some number of jobs with some interdependencies, and then they reach a conclusion. And so you'll hear them talked about that way. Maybe help me there, Jason. So, and not to throw a wrinkle here, but so workflow orchestration versus something that is more seen as like, I would call like a pipeline, like Spark or something. What's the sort of distinction, you know, between, or where's a line, or is it blurry? Like what's the difference between something that would be viewed as more like pipeline versus workflow orchestration?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't have an easy answer, but basically I would say, okay, one thing a workflow orchestrator cannot do is it cannot fuse nodes together. So you kind of explicitly define like, do this task, do that task, do that task, and they all depend on each other or in a sequence or something. And if tasks like B and C really could be fused into one operation, it won't do that because it makes no assumption about what programming language or what version of Ubuntu is running on that node or anything like that. They're all just basically Docker containers that are getting spun up. You can actually, depending on the orchestrator you use, some orchestrators have it where you can spin up a container for a particular node and that container can do multiple tasks. So let's say I have 10 videos, I have to transcode all of them to QuickTime. I have a QuickTime node, and that node could do all 10 of them, right? But by default, most of these orchestrators, you actually spin up a Docker container, do that one thing that one time, and then tear it back down. And so there's a pretty heavy spin up, spin down time for tests. So conversely, with Spark, like you do create sort of a DAG, and same with early versions of PyTorch, or if you do PyTorch.compile, or early versions of TensorFlow, you would create a DAG of operations, and then what the Spark compiler or PyTorch compiler or TensorFlow will do is it will fuse operations and it will create this like super optimized DAG. And it does that because all of the operations are within its own ecosystem. So like, you know, Spark has a limited vocabulary, as does PyTorch. And so this being so open-ended, it can just run any Docker container with any arguments you want. That open-endedness comes at a cost.
All right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Cool. So, quick rundown on the steps to use a workflow orchestrator. Typically, you containerize your tasks. That's usually, you know, pretty straightforward. Most people are using Docker anyways. But you also have to containerize the workflow itself. So the file that says, you know, run this task and then run the second task afterwards, like that logic has to go somewhere. And so all of these examples that we'll talk about in the future, they all do it differently. And then after that, you're kind of off to the races. You submit jobs. One thing that is that varies a lot from orchestrator to orchestrator is how to pass data among the tasks. So the early versions of these, the only way you could pass information was through arguments. So, job one finishes and then it's allowed to inject some command line arguments into job two, but that's it. And because it's a command line argument, you can't stick like a whole JSON blob in there, a large JSON blob or anything like that. You couldn't put an image in there or something. And so what you have to do for these early ones is use something else to store everything. So, you know, the task transcodes the video and then it doesn't pass the transcoded video onto the next task, which maybe like sets a flag in a database saying it's ready. But what it does, it puts the transcoded video into some object store like S3 or something else. And then all it passes to the next task is maybe a unique ID of the video. Later versions, they allow you to pass arbitrary data, but under the hood, they're doing the same thing. So when you pass like a pandas data frame or an image or something from one task to the other, under the hood, it's actually storing it in S3 in some temporary bucket, which has like a low retention policy, and then pulling it back out for the next. That's all there is to it. So it's really not that hard. I would say this is in the category of things that kind of like functional programming languages, where it's kind of a unique paradigm. If you've never used a workflow orchestrator, it can look very daunting. But once you've learned one, now you kind of can do pretty much all of them pretty easily.
I haven't used one, but I a lot of these names are familiar. So,
really? You haven't? Well, what about like a proprietary one or something? I'm sure you've had something.
I guess that's true, but I feel like it's a bit different. Like if someone else already has like all of the setup, I've sort of been a part of one of them, I guess. So other people sets up the stuff and I, you know, define some portion of some code that needs to run and someone is sucking it up into a container and running it. Yeah, that way. But I've never sat down and had to write in the language of describing the workflow as an example.
That makes sense. Yeah. At Meta, we had something called DataStorm, which is very similar to the ones we'll talk about next. But I never worked on DataStorm. I was mostly a customer. But they all are extremely similar. And I think a lot of these cases, like DataStorm's an example, there was something called Flume, which was similar to Spark, kind of like a combination of Spark and a workflow orchestrator. And then someone made an open source version of that. I think most people will encounter workflow orchestrators. It might just be a homegrown one instead of one of these ones.
Yeah, that's true.
But the big market share ones are Airflow. Airflow is an Apache project. I don't know the history of Airflow, but It's kind of the 900-pound gorilla in the room. So if you're on AWS, there's something called MWAA, which is managed. I don't know what the W is, but the A's are Apache Airflow. And basically, you don't even have to set up Airflow yourself on any computer or anything like that. They just do everything for you. It's kind of like RDS for databases. So RDS, an example, like you don't have to like install Postgres on a machine yourself or anything like that. They have the same thing for Airflow. Airflow is, you know, legacy. It's doesn't have a lot of the features of the other ones we'll talk about, but you know, you can feel confident that Airflow can do almost anything. Like if you can't get it done in Airflow, what that means is of the thousands and thousands of developers, nobody's tried to do what you're trying to do, which is maybe a sign that you're doing something wrong. It's kind of in that category where too big to fail, I guess. But it is legacy. I think it's originally in Java. And because Airflow is so open-ended, you know, it's not hooked into any one language that well, I would say, is my biggest detractor of Airflow. Some other examples, I used Dagster a lot. Dagster is quite nice. I think it's Python only, or if it's not, there's maybe a REST API that would be pretty ugly to use, but it's really meant for Python. It's nice. It gives you little decorators, so you can decorate functions as Dagster nodes. And so when a function calls another, if it calls a Dagster node as a, you know, function, it'll return back a future, and Dagster kind of handles all of that for you. So it kind of pauses the operation of your function, calls that dependent task, and then comes back and gives you your function back, which is pretty clever, pretty cool. So Temporal is, they actually just raised, I think, a Series B. I'm going to double check. Yeah, they raised 2.5 billion is their valuation. Series C they raised. It's pretty cool. So it's kind of a different take. You don't have the dashboard. You don't have a lot of the things we talked about that are important, but it just gives you the bare thing that really matters, which is being able to run a function and know you're going to get an answer regardless of how long that function takes. So Temporal would be a good thing if you're building your own workflow orchestrator. I think Temporal would be a good thing to build it on top of. And it might even be that Dagster uses Temporal. It's very possible. But it is kind of like lower level, you know, really calling individual functions durably. Similar to Temporal, there's Apache Ray. So Ray comes from this company called AnyScale. Ray is also pretty low level. So, you know, you're calling individual functions, and it has to be kind of in Python. And so it's hooking in at a pretty low level, kind of like Temporal. The thing that's really powerful about Ray is just how unbelievably fast it is. So with Ray, you spin up all the machines in advance. So, you know, all these other workflow orchestrators, you know, you're spinning up a machine, doing some work, and then spinning it back down. With Ray, you spin up a whole cluster. When that whole cluster is up and running, you then execute a bunch of functions, and those functions get farmed out to that cluster you span up for that particular task you're doing. And so it's a fully connected mesh of machines. And then when you're finished your task, that entire cluster gets spun down. So you're paying a bigger hit up front, but you're getting like super, super low latency. Like you never have to worry, once the whole cluster is up, you never have to worry about any node requiring another machine or anything like that. And the final example I have, which folks should know about, is Kubeflow. Kubeflow is similar in a sense to Airflow. The big difference is they've integrated a dashboard where you can upload different statistics. So for example, you know, Airflow is a dashboard where you can monitor the jobs. and see, oh, I have 5 failed jobs yesterday. Kubeflow has that too. But Kubeflow allows you to, like, each run have a dashboard for that specific run. And so it's like, okay, task 3, you know, output a time series graph, and here it is. Task 4 created a scatter plot, and there it is. And so for workflows that, you know, are producing statistical outputs, that's like a nice feature to have.
It sounds like some of them are, like you said, sort of lower level. Like Ray sort of sounds like it's shorter. You want higher, you know, response, lower response times, lower latency. You want to be able to do lots and lots and lots of things. You want to sort of shard them all up and have them sort of distributed. And then other things, like you were sort of saying, like transcoding a video or something, you pretty much want to, like, do a bunch of data reading, do a bunch of processing, kind of do a bunch of data writing, you know, as far as, like, externally. So you're sort of dealing with large blobbed objects and very long run times. And so it feels like there isn't a generic solution that just sort of, like, meshes over all of it, which I guess kind of makes sense. And as you were sort of saying, I think whether one sort of container can be multi-purpose or whether you really are needing different containers for all of the different jobs probably plays a huge role in sort of, like, how easy or hard it is.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's one of these things that, like, the lines are a little blurry because I'm sure someone's going to email us saying, oh, well, you could do actually this in Airflow, or, you know, Ray could also do that. But just generally speaking, like, at the baseline level, you know, Ray is not durable. So if your Ray job, you know, you're responsible for doing checkpointing and things like that. You know, if your Ray job dies halfway through, it's just gone. It, you know, whatever checkpoint you have is whatever you created. You know, these other ones, you know, they'll just by their nature, they're constantly creating checkpoints. And so, yeah, there's basically several things you're juggling. You know, how durable do you want these tasks to be, these parts of your workflow? And then what's your latency requirement? And then what's your sort of cost you're willing to spend? Because Ray, you know, for every... So just to give an example, let's say you have some type of task and that task has a list of Python third-party libraries that need to be run, need to be included. So if you do Airflow, you know, when that task node spins up, it spins up your Docker container where you've already put those libraries in it, right? And it's ready to go and it executes your code and that's fine. With Ray, you create a Docker container with those dependencies similar to with Airflow. But you spin up an entire cluster and every node on that cluster has all those Python dependencies. You know, so if you have especially like heterogeneous things where maybe you have one task that requires Torch, which is like a 2 gigabyte PyPy file, right? And then you have another task that's just send an email, you know, that only requires like the base Ubuntu. You know, then Airflow is going to save you a little bit there. So yeah, there's no free lunch. There's like kind of several things to juggle. I guess, so some advice, I think Ray is you should only use Ray if latency is important. So if you're doing ML training, latency is very important. You have this GPU, it's very expensive. You don't want to waste time on it. So that's why Ray is extremely popular for training these AI models. If you're doing ML stuff or things where you're producing a lot of, you know, graphs and a lot of those artifacts, I think Kubeflow could be a good choice. And for everything else, I would use Dagster if what you're doing is in Python. Otherwise, I would use Airflow. So that's sort of the workflow diagram of which workflow orchestrator to pick.
Yeah. We need this all prescribed out for us. I guess this is called a flow chart, but yeah, okay.
Oh, that's true. Cool. Yeah, I guess, you know, some like things to avoid other than rolling your own orchestrator is I think you can go the other direction and kind of make things super complicated with, you know, auto scaling and a lot of these other things. I think, you know, you can take baby steps with these things. Just like anything, you can kind of start getting into it and end up diving super, super deep and saying like, oh, I'm going to preload the nodes with these packages and at the end of the day, like, you know, this, you want this to save you time. You don't want this to have to cost you a lot of time.
Makes sense. Thanks for the overview.
Yeah.
Deep dive? Yeah. The education.
Yeah. This is a good thing to learn, folks. I think this is super, super useful. If you are like looking to get started, imagine you have like a website that's, that has any type of job that needs to get done. I'm trying to think of a good example. Like you have a website that just OCRs pictures. Someone puts drags a picture into your website and you send them back some text or something in an email. And nowadays, OCR is so bloody fast that like you can just respond instantly. But let's pretend like we're still where that took a long time. You know, just spin up Temporal. You know, I think it's relatively easy to stand up. I think they have a managed service too. It's very reasonably priced. And say, look, like I'm going to call this function to do the OCR, and that function is going to do the OCR and send the email. And I'm just going to wrap it in Temporal, and now it's durable. And that could be just an easy way to get started.
Cool.
All right. Yeah, we hope you folks liked the episode, and definitely keep sending us, you know, requests for new content. New show ideas. We take them super seriously. We've implemented many of them. So our list is getting smaller. So if you have a show topic, please Slack us or Discord us. I mean, email us, however you want to reach out to us.
Thank you, everyone.
Music by Eric Barndollar.
Programming Throwdown is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 2.0 license. You're free to share, copy, distribute, transmit the work, to remix, adapt the work, but you must provide an attribution to Patrick and I, and share alike in kind.